Thanks.
Thanks for the invitation to come and speak to you, and I guess we'll continue on with the theme of slow flow in small places and things that we don't understand. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the research that we're doing in this area. Let me start off with an overview or outline of my presentation today. I'm going to give a little bit of background information, just basically what is glaucoma, what does it have to do with aqueous humor dynamics, and what are the research questions that we're trying to answer. And then I'm going to talk to you about some of the modeling that we've carried out to date and what we've learned from it and what we know from it. And I think that you'll quickly come to the conclusion that the state of the art is fairly primitive, which leads to the question, are there some further advances that could be made through some more sophisticated modeling? And I think the answer to that question is yes, and so I'd like to end off the talk by presenting some problems that I think are interesting, and they're certainly unsolved, to try to stimulate a little bit of interest. So let's start off with some background material. This is a cross-sectional view through the human eye, and as you remember, light enters the eye through the cornea, passes through the lens before impinging on the retina at the back of the eye. And these two tissues here have to be clear to allow light to pass through, which precludes the existence of a vascular supply to the tissues. Yet there are living cells within both the cornea and the lens, and so how do you supply nutrients to those tissues? Well, the eye has solved this problem by secreting a clear colorless fluid called the aqueous humor, and it's pumped out by a specialized tissue and flows as shown by the yellow arrows here. And I was interested to think about the cerebral spinal fluid, which is virtually just ripping along compared to the aqueous humor, because we're talking about 2.5 microliters a minute, or about 150 microliters per hour. So it's really quite slow. Now, the fluid then drains out of the eye, and there's some resistance to its drainage as it passes out of the eye, which means that there's a positive pressure within the eye, and that's the so-called intraocular pressure. And IOP, or intraocular pressure, is very important in glaucoma because in most cases of the disease, the intraocular pressure is elevated. And that means that just like this situation with hydrocephalus, it's not the high pressure per se that's bad, but eventually if that pressure is allowed to stay elevated, it causes damage to the optic nerve here, which is responsible for carrying the visual information from the retina to the brain, and blindness results. In fact, glaucoma is the second most common cause of blindness in Canada and Western countries, so it's quite a serious disease. It's a very hard disease to diagnose and a very hard disease to treat, mostly because we don't understand very much about it. And the reason that the intraocular pressure is elevated in glaucoma has everything to do with these tissues out of through which the aqueous humor drains as it passes out of the eye. Basically, they have too much resistance or the drain gets plugged, is the bottom line. So let's focus in on these tissues, which are shown magnified on the right-hand side here. And the aqueous humor is flowing, as is shown by the blue arrow here. And the first tissue which I want to draw to your attention is called the trabecular meshwork. And it's a porous connective tissue, which is approximately wedge-shaped. After passing through the trabecular meshwork, the aqueous humor then gets into Schlemm's canal, which in some ways is like a lymphatic collecting duct for the aqueous humor circulation in the eye, although that's not quite true. I'm going to talk a lot today about something called the juxtacanalicular tissue, which is a subpart of the trabecular meshwork. So there's a lot of terminology here. And just to try to reinforce that, I'm showing you here a cross-sectional view through the outflow system of the human eye. So here's Schlemm's canal here. The orientation has been changed slightly, so now the aqueous humor is flowing up in this direction. And I'll just draw your attention to the juxtacanalicular tissue, or JCT. So as its name implies, it's right next to Schlemm's canal. And Schlemm's canal itself is lined by an endothelial monolayer, layer of endothelial cells, and we differentiate between the inner wall and the outer wall. And the reason that we do that is that as the aqueous humor flows, it first of all percolates through the juxtacanalicular tissue, and then it has to cross this endothelial monolayer to get into the lumen of the canal. And as we'll find out, that's a little bit of an arduous journey for it. Okay? So just to remind, the key tissues here are the JCT and the inner wall of Schlemm's canal, this endothelial monolayer. Why are these the key tissues? Well, experimental data measurements show that the intraocular pressure in normal eyes is controlled by the juxtacanalicular tissue or the inner wall endothelium of Schlemm's canal, or both. Unfortunately, it's not possible to measure any more finely than that. More importantly, there's a lot of evidence that indicates the elevated pressure in glaucoma is due to changes in these tissues, basically their resistance going up. So the focus of our lab and others is to focus on the juxtacanalicular tissue and inner wall of Schlemm's canal. So that leads to a series of questions that we would like to have the answers to, a series of research questions. We would like to know what cellular and molecular processes control outflow resistance in the normal eye. Notice that I said normal eye. We do not understand how the resistance is set even in the normal, healthy eye. And related to that, we ask the question, is the juxtacanalicular tissue the site of action, or is it the inner wall of Schlemm's canal? We really don't know which of those is most important. Or maybe there are interactions between the JCT and the inner wall of Schlemm's canal that we need to be concerned with. And then the money question is really, what causes the elevated outflow resistance in glaucoma? Now, if you ask those questions, then you immediately, or at least by implication, define a set of objectives, and they are to determine the source of aqueous outflow resistance in normal eyes. I would actually be happy if I could understand how a normal eye works. To determine the cause of elevated outflow resistance in glaucomatous eyes. Along the way, we're going to have fun characterizing the biomechanics of the outflow system because it's very interesting. And if we were lucky, we could get rich by developing improved treatments for glaucoma. All right, so that concludes the background section of the talk. And what I would like to do now is talk to you about some of the modeling that's been carried out to date. And basically, this modeling comes in three flavors. First of all, I'm going to talk to you about the flow through the juxtacanalicular tissue. Then I'm going to talk to you about flow across the inner wall endothelial lining of Schlemm's canal. And then I'm going to talk to you about interactions between those two regions. So let's start off with the juxtacanalicular tissue. Here's a transmission electron micrograph through the JCT. So the aqueous humor starts off in the lower, well, actually it starts off somewhere in the basement. But for purposes of this picture, it starts off in the lower corner here and tries to get into Schlemm's canal up here. And I'd like to draw three components to your attention in this picture. The dark materials here are our cells. This sort of gray fluffy material is extracellular matrix components. And then these apparently open spaces are presumably flow channels. And if I were a molecule of aqueous humor, I would want to wind my way along through these open spaces before getting into Schlemm's canal. Now, when you look at the structure of these open spaces, they're tortuous and interconnected and have a random geometry. And so it's sensible to treat this as a porous material. And what we would like to do is know something about the flow resistance of this tissue here as a function of its ultrastructure, local properties. And the standard way that you would do that is use something called the Karman-Kozny equation to estimate the hydraulic permeability. Now, hydraulic permeability, capital K, is basically flow conductance per unit tissue area, cross-sectional tissue area. It depends just on the local microstructure of the porous material. And the Karman-Kozny equation is a standard equation in porous media theory, which basically assumes that the material is permeated by a network of pores and make some estimates about flow resistance within the pores. And it tells us that the permeability here depends on three quantities. The first is the porosity, which is the void fraction within the tissue. And we can actually estimate that from a micrograph such as this. We measure the open areas here, and we divide by the total tissue area, and that gives us an estimate of the volume of open space per volume of tissue. The second quantity is something called the specific surface, and it's defined to be the surface area that the fluid touches as it flows through per unit volume of tissue. And that makes sense because, remember, the pressure drop comes about due to viscous drag on the walls or the solid elements of the tissue. And so we can actually estimate that because it is going to be the perimeter of the solid elements here divided by the area of the tissue, which we can again measure from a micrograph such as this. And the third quantity is something called Kozny's constant, which actually isn't a constant, but it's approximately constant. It depends a little bit on the pore geometry. It turns out that you could be wrong by 50% in this number here, but as you will see, I would be delighted if we were accurate to within 50%, so we'll count that as negligible inaccuracy. So what we did was we measured these parameters in normal and different kinds of glaucoma to size, the porosity and specific surface, plugged into the Karman-Kosny equation, got a permeability, and then knowing a few other things about the tissue, like its cross-sectional area and flow-wise length, we can calculate a flow resistance in the juxtacanalicular tissue. And if we just focus in on the normalize here, and sorry about the units, with due deference to my medical colleagues, they do love them. Millimeters of mercury per microliter per minute. I'm not sure what international system that falls within, but anyway, the bottom line is that there's a range here associated with some uncertainty in the measurements, but basically we're talking about something that's around 0.08 or 0.09 resistance units at most. Now, we can actually estimate the real resistance by making direct pressure measurements, and it turns out that the real resistance is somewhere around 2.5. And I said there was some uncertainty here, but not this much. This is almost two orders of magnitude, and as much as you try to fool around with the numbers, you can never make these things match up. So we're doing something wrong. And the conclusion that we came to was that all of those empty, well, first of all, it's clear that all of those empty spaces within the juxtacanalicular tissue generate very little flow resistance. There's basically too many holes in the tissue. So what are we doing wrong? Well, we decided that maybe those spaces weren't actually empty. Why would we think that? Well, we know that these cells secrete extracellular matrix components called glycosaminoglycans, which are not preserved when you make this kind of a picture. In fact, they're the first thing to go. And so the hypothesis is that those spaces that we thought were empty were actually filled with glycosaminoglycans or GAGs or some actually glycoconjugates, which just means that they're hooked up with proteins. And so what we wanted to do was extend the model to include the presence of these glycoconjugates. And how do we do that? Well, we would need to know a couple of things. First of all, we would need to know how much of this glycoconjugate stuff is there. And that's been measured by Paul Knepper's lab in Chicago for actually both for normal and glaucoma to size. And it turns out there's different kinds of glycosaminoglycans, and they measured them all. And then we would need to know how much flow resistance a given mass of glycoconjugate created. Or in other words, we would need to know the permeability, capital K, as a function of the concentration of the glycoconjugate. And parenthetically, you can make quite a nice model of this by treating these glycoconjugate fibers as a random array of cylinders. And that's what the solid line gives you. And then there's some data that actually miraculously agrees with that. And when you put that all together, it turns out that the concentrations of glycoconjugates or glycosaminoglycans that are present in the tissue are exactly consistent or entirely consistent with the observed resistance. In other words, the idea is that those empty spaces, all the modeling is consistent with the fact that those empty spaces are filled up with these glycoconjugate materials, and that gives us just the right amount of resistance that we can measure. And there's some data that actually supports that whole hypothesis. So that seems to work quite nicely. So that's what I'm going to say about the juxtacanalicular tissue for right now. Now what I'd like to do is pop back and talk a little bit about the inner wall of Schlemm's canal, that endothelial lining. This is a scanning electron micrograph, and basically it's like we were inside Schlemm's canal looking down on the endothelial cells. And if we show this picture to an endothelial cell biologist, he or she will tell you, oh, this looks really bad. Your cells are extremely sick. They have all of these bulges here, and look, there's even holes in them. Well, I can assure you that these cells are actually quite healthy, and this is entirely normal. And there's a good reason for these that I'll discuss later on in the talk. Right now, I'd like to focus in on these holes. We call them pores, and we believe that those are the route whereby the aqueous humor fluid crosses this endothelial monolayer. So it's coming out of the screen at you. You can see there's actually tracer studies where stuff goes through those pores. And you immediately see that the flow resistance of this layer of cells is going to depend on how many of these pores there are and how big they are, which you can measure from a micrograph. And in fact, if you do that on lots of micrographs, you get graphs like this. This is the pores per unit area as a function of pore size. just to show you that the average pore size is somewhere between 1 and 1.5 microns, and there's about 1,000 per square millimeter. And then if you use Samson's solution, which is flow through a circular orifice in an infinite plane bounded on both sides by fluid, it's an exact solution in the case of a vanishingly small Reynolds number, the flow rate through that orifice is proportional to the pressure drop, the cube of the radius of the orifice, and inversely proportional to the fluid viscosity. You can use this to get a conductance for each little hole. We know how many holes there are, and so we can actually get a conductance for that whole endothelial monolayer or flow resistance. And when we do that, it turns out there's not very much resistance there at all, only about 10% of the total. And you see that's beautiful because it's exactly consistent with the idea that most of the resistance is in the juxtacanalicular tissue. And so we have this great model of the outflow system that seems to be really self-consistent and everything. There's only one small problem, which is it is directly and aggressively contradicted by a large body of experimental data. Right? And here's one such example of that data. This is from our lab where we perfused a pair of post-mortem human eyes. And so we have on the vertical axis facility, which is what the ophthalmologists like to use. It's the inverse of resistance. As a function of time, the eye represented by the blue curve is the control eye. Its partner got a drug right here, which you can see had a rather profound effect on facility. It made the resistance go way, way down. Well, what is that drug? It's something called Lotrunculin B, and what it does is it interferes with the polymerization of actin, which is a major component of the cytoskeleton. And the cytoskeleton is the cell's internal skeleton, which basically gives it mechanical integrity and rigidity. So what is it about this drug that makes the resistance go way down? Well, here's what the control eye looks like. So you see all these funny bulges in the inner Waller-Schlemm's canal and a couple of holes here and there. Here's what a Lotrunculin B eye looks like. First of all, the vacuoles are really weird. They're sort of deflated looking, and I think that's exactly consistent with what would happen if you change the mechanical integrity of the cells. But the striking finding is that there's many, many pores, and they're huge. In fact, there's about triple the number of pores in a normal eye, and they're about 2 to 4 times as large. And we say, wow, that's really interesting. So here we have a layer of cells that has no flow resistance or almost no flow resistance in it at all. In other words, it doesn't matter very much. And yet, when I put more holes in it, the whole flow resistance of the system goes way down. So that's contradictory, highly contradictory. And this is one piece of data. There's actually lots of data that all points in that same general direction. So what I would like to do now is talk to you about interaction between that endothelial layer of cells and the juxtacanalicular tissue and try to explain how this we could reconcile the data. And the key observation is that these pores are rare. And when I say rare, they cover about 0.1% of the total area of this endothelial monolayer. And that has an interesting implication. If we think about just a simple model here, here's the juxtacanalicular tissue, this gray shaded zone here, the aqueous humor is flowing from top to bottom here. Here are the cells of the inner wall of Schlemm's canal with pores, shown here highly magnified for clarity. There actually isn't a gap here, so just ignore this white space in here. The presence of these pores and the rarity of them means that as the aqueous humor comes down through the juxtacanalicular tissue, it can't pass through the cells, so it has to funnel down towards the pores. It's like driving on the highway and having to stop at the toll booth. It doesn't matter how fast you can go here, it's all controlled by what's happening around the pores. And so the pressure drop in a porous material, of course, is directly proportional to its velocity. And the velocity here is higher just from conservation of mass as the fluid funnels in. And so you get a bigger pressure drop here. And it's quite simple to model that. We treat the juxtacanalicular tissue as a Darcyan porous material so that the local fluid velocity is proportional to the pressure gradient. The constant of proportionality is the ratio of the permeability to the fluid viscosity. The flow is incompressible, and therefore the pressure just satisfies Laplace's equation in the juxtacanalicular tissue. You assume a uniform pressure up here, a zero pressure at the mouth of the pores, and impermeable condition here at where the cells are. And it's quite easy to figure out the resistance of this juxtacanalicular tissue compared to what you would have if these cells were not here. So it's very important to understand that it's not that the cells have resistance, it's that they enhance the resistance of the juxtacanalicular tissue by making the fluid funnel through the juxtacanalicular tissue. And the bottom line out of all of this is you can calculate this resistance enhancement for various geometric parameters, the details of which I won't go into. The human eye, the normal human eye, operates right around here, and you get a resistance enhancement factor of as much as a factor of 30. So it's a lot. And you see, the key point here is that the resistance enhancement factor critically depends on how many pores you have and how big they are. So basically, the hypothesis here that is suggested by the modeling is that the pores are actually modulating the effective resistance of the juxtacanalicular tissue, which is entirely consistent with, I would say, almost all of the data. In medicine, you never agree with all of the data. You just do the best you can. So that's kind of the state of the art right now about how we think about flow out of the eye. Now, what I would like to do is, so there's not much mathematical sophistication there, in case you didn't notice. Now I'd like to talk about some interesting unsolved problems, and if anybody's got any great ideas about this, please contact me. And the first one I would like to talk about is what controls the distribution of inner wall pores. So to tell you about this, I have to describe an experimental measurement to you. What we do is we take human eyes, and, oh, by the way, only humans get glaucoma as far as we know, so there's no animal model for the disease, which is why we like to use human eyes. And we open up Schlemm's canal. It's a bit tricky. We cut it open, and then we basically fold it open like a book so you can read the endothelial cells. And here's what happens when you look at the book. Here's the spine of the book where you folded it open. Here's the inner wall of Schlemm's canal. So in this part, the fluid is coming out of the page at you. Here's the outer wall of Schlemm's canal. So imagine that folded back together. And you might be wondering, what is this here? Well, where does the fluid go after it gets into Schlemm's canal? Well, it goes out one of these collector channels here. There's about 30 of them around the eye. So this is the drain of Schlemm's canal, or one of the drains of Schlemm's canal. And the question is the distribution of pores on the inner wall of Schlemm's canal uniform, or do there tend to be more around the collector channels? And as a hint, I've written the title, Pores Are Non-Uniform. How do we know that? Well, we made a little grid, measured lots of micrographs like this, and counted pores as a function of distance away from a collector channel ostium. And the data is here. This is the number of pores per unit area as a function away from the distance of the collector channel. Close to the collector channel, there's lots. As you go away, it goes down like this. The blue line is the uniform pore expected density, and the purple lines are the confidence intervals associated with the hypothesis that the pores are uniform. So yes, there really are more pores near the collector channel. And you might say, well, that's obvious, isn't it? Because wouldn't it be easier for the fluid, once it gets into the canal, just to go out right here? So it should come out by the collector channel, right? Well, not so obvious, because if you look at a model that was put together by my colleague Mark Johnson and colleagues Mark Johnson and Roger Kam, what they did was they modeled the whole outflow system. So here we have, this is Schlemm's canal here. This is the juxtacanalicular tissue, an inner wall is the black line. Here's a collector channel, here's another collector channel. And of course, as the fluid flows, the aqueous humor fluid flows along Schlemm's canal like this, it experiences a pressure drop, which means that the pressure here is less than the pressure over here, which means that because the trabecular meshwork is elastic, it means that the canal is more collapsed here than it is over here. And the question is, how much pressure drop occurs along here compared to, say, across here? Because if there's a huge pressure drop here, it's very advantageous for the fluid to come through over here. If there's not much pressure drop, then it's just as happy to come through anywhere. So to model that, what they did was they assumed that the local flow resistance of this tissue here was constant, so that the if x is the distance along Schlemm's canal, the flow rate Q entering per unit length is just proportional to the pressure out here minus the local pressure in the canal divided by a resistance. They treated Schlemm's canal as being basically two parallel plates with creeping flow in between, which is not such a bad assumption to get a local measure of the pressure drop. And they assumed that this tissue here is linearly elastic. And when you punch all the numbers in and solve that out, it turns out that this pressure drop across here is very, very small, some fractions of a millimeter of mercury, which means that fluid should be just as happy to come through here as over here, except the pores, there's way more here. So there's some contradiction here that I totally do not understand. It should be possible to make a model of this whole thing, except I don't know how to do that. So if anyone has a great idea about that, I'd love to hear it. Another open question is, how is the system stable? And let me describe to you what I mean by that. Here's my juxtacanalicular tissue again with the blue gel filling up the spaces. And suppose that there was a small perturbation locally so that there was a little bit less gel. Maybe a cell got tired of making the gel for a few minutes or something like that. Well, if there's less gel and the gel exerts a flow resistance, then there should be more flow through the place where there's less gel. And we're pretty sure that the flow actually carries gel away with it. So when there's more flow there, then it carries some gel away and then there's even less gel. So more flow comes and then less gel comes. And pretty soon you have a preferential flow channel or pathway, and it's sort of like a river cutting a new bed when it's meandering on a floodplain. Once it starts, you can't stop it. And so the implication of that is that you should have a few major pathways through the meshwork here, and then the whole rest of it is kind of like a backwater which doesn't get perfused. Except that isn't what we see, as far as we can tell, from looking at lots and lots of tissue. So why doesn't that happen? I think that related to that is the fact that the pressure in the eye is constantly varying. This is from a study which is, they actually put a needle in the eye of a living volunteer. I assume that was before they had institutional review boards, and measured the pressure in real time as the person blinked, squeezed their eyelids, moved their eyes around, and then just sat there. And the pressure, remember that the mean pressure in the eye is 15 millimeters of mercury in a healthy eye. So we're talking about when you squeeze your eyes, you get an 80 millimeter of mercury pressure variation. And even just sitting there, because blood is pulsing in and out of the eye and the choroid, the volume of the eye is changing, and that changes the pressure in the eye. So the system is constantly being exposed to a pulsatile perturbation in pressure. And I'm convinced that it has something to do with making sure that this flow channeling doesn't occur. But darned if I can figure out how to model that. Last two things. How can inner wall cells survive? There's a funny thing about Schlemm's canal. The pressure gradient is from the base of the cell to the top of the cell, and the cells are joined by tight junctions, which is very weird. It doesn't usually happen that way in the body. Usually when the cells are tightly joined like this, the pressure gradient is the other way. So I like to think of this as, you know, you're trying to pick a cat up off of a bedspread and it's holding on with its claws for dear life. That's what these cells are doing here. And this explains why they show all these funny bulges that I pointed out to you before. And we call those giant vacuoles, and here's one here. And it turns out that if I rub my eye like this, which we all do every day, the pressure in it goes to about 120 millimeters of mercury. The cells stretch by about 50% when you do that, as far as we can tell. Which is interesting because normally if you stretch a cell by more than about 10%, depends on the cell, it dies right away. Right? So the question is, how do the cells live on the inner wall of Schlemm's canal? They should all be dead the first time you rub your eye. We actually did some simple modeling with this. We assumed that inner wall cells are passively deformed by a pressure difference across this endothelial monolayer. And we treated the cell like a linearly elastic membrane undergoing large deformation. The large deformation part is certainly accurate. Linearly elastic is not. I'm running a little bit out of time here, so I'm just going to skip over. Just to say that there's experimental measurements of how big these bulges are as a function of pressure. And we can also estimate the pressure drop across the eye. And there's an ancient solution due to Hanke of deformation of a circular membrane under pressure, which actually gives you the Young's modulus of the membrane material. And when you figure that out, it gives you, so this is a plot, this is Young's modulus here, and this is a slightly complicated graph. I'll just say that our best estimate of the stiffness is somewhere up here, and all other types of endothelial cells are somewhere down here. So the cells are stiffer. Maybe that has something to do with the fact that they survive, although I don't think it explains very much of it. So we really don't understand kind of very much about the micromechanics of those inner wall cells, which could be very important in glaucoma. Which brings me to my last topic, which is what controls the stiffness of the inner wall endothelial cells. Because you see, those cells, they do have to deform because they're constantly getting pushed by the pressure all the time. And if for some reason they could deform less, for why we're not sure, then they probably wouldn't be able to make as many pores, and that would be problematic in terms of this funneling model that I described to you earlier. So wouldn't it be interesting if there was some data that showed that cells, say, from glaucoma eyes were stiffer than cells from normal eyes? So let's come back and look at these cells here. So this is our preparation, and actually we fluorescently labeled the cells, and what I'm showing you here is a series of micrographs, basically optical sections down through the inner wall of Schlemm's canal. The red here is actin, which is sort of the main structural protein of the cytoskeleton, or one of the main structural proteins. The blue are nuclei, and this is from a normal healthy eye, as far as we know, other than the fact that the patient wasn't alive. You can see that the actin basically runs in a big fat band around the outside of the cell, which I think actually makes sense if it's trying desperately to hang on to its neighbors, which it is. And this is just sectioning down optically through the tissue. So that's a normal eye. Now here's what a glaucoma eye looks like. You can see that the actin doesn't run in a big fat band around the outside of the cell, but it's a big sort of tangled mess. And I would bet that this cell is stiffer than the one that I just showed you on the previous picture. Right? And we should be able to actually model the effects of this different actin distribution on the mechanical properties of the cell. So that's a challenging open question. So just to try to summarize, I think we would all agree that aqueous outflow dynamics are poorly understood in both normal and glaucoma eyes. Modeling has helped us, definitely, but there's a lot more understanding which is required. Before I close off, I would like to acknowledge my longtime collaborator, Mark Johnson, Northwestern University, and my technicians who put up with me for some amazing reason, Darren Chan and Tom Reed, and also financial support from a number of sources. So thank you for your attention.